Hello and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. Today's topic relates to elder caring coordination. We'll talk about how court-ordered dispute resolution can increase safety and empower the voice of older adults in families with high conflict dynamics. If you have an older adult in your life, or you practice in probate court, you'll be especially interested to hear how elder caring coordination respects the elder's need for autonomy and safety. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 13. Our topic is safeguarding older adults through elder caring coordination. Joining me today, one from the Badger State and one from the Sunshine State, are Sue Bronson and Linda Fieldstone. Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
Sue, you are a mediator with a whopping 35 years of experience. Has mediation changed since you started in the field?
Absolutely. When I first began, no one even knew what it was. I had to go around and tell people about it. Now, the fun thing about it was when I explained the process, they all wanted to know where they could get training. And now it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's definitely so hot. And I think it just keeps growing in popularity, it seems.
Not only in popular attempts. So what started mediation and spread with like workplace, special education has finally come to older families.
Interestingly, you are also a psychotherapist helping to strengthen relationships and provide healing from trauma. Does your background in psychotherapy inform your dispute resolution practice?
Absolutely. That to me, it's so important that we focus on the people in dispute and not the topic of the dispute. That if you address the people and have compassion for the struggle that they're in, for that sense of powerlessness, we're going to get a solution that is lasting and meaningful and not just a twisted arm sort of agreement that doesn't last.
That makes sense. And currently you teach mediation at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, but you've also conducted trainings nationwide. But another thing I wanted to mention that you are the co-chair of the Association for Conflict Resolution Elder Justice Initiative on Elder Caring Coordination and a committee chair for the American Bar Association Task Force on Elder Abuse Screening for Mediators. What started your interest in justice for elders?
It began with a tragic accident in my family where my sister-in-law became brain injured. And so I thought I wanted to work with people with disabilities. And I found that it was too close to home. But elders was the other half of that that was often talked together, you know, vulnerable adults. And so I had a desire to move on to elders. And the real thrust is delightful Linda, who talked to me about elder caring care.
Oh, that's nice. And I would like to say hello to Linda Fieldstone, our other guest today. Linda is a family conflict dispute resolution specialist in the Miami-Dade area. And Linda, you work as a parenting coordinator, family mediator, elder caring coordinator. You've been working with families for a long time. What do you find rewarding about this type of work?
I worked most of the time within the Miami-Dade court family division as supervisor of family court services there. I worked with high conflict families all during that time who were court ordered to services within our unit. And the reward was understanding the impact that it could have to help families talk about solutions together, and that it could affect more than the people who are just in the room. So while I worked mostly with the parents, for instance, I knew that the impact would also be the children. And that's the impetus for relating to older families as well, understanding the impact affects all of the generations.
Linda is also the co-chair of the ACR Elder Justice Initiative on Elder Caring Coordination after spearheading the Association for Conflict Resolution and Florida Chapter Association of Family and Conciliation Courts Task Forces in 2013 in a groundbreaking collaboration of 20 U.S. and Canadian organizations and 20 statewide entities who developed guidelines in elder caring coordination. And elder caring coordination has since been recognized by the United Nations as an action model for the welfare of aging persons. That's a great recognition. Was your team proud when that happened?
I would say not only were we were proud, but we were so excited to have that kind of highlight on elder caring coordination because we understood the importance of that as the field developed. And our goal is to have elder caring coordination accessible to as many people as possible around the world, actually, not just in one location, but anywhere that elders can be and their families can be assisted by the process. So it's been very helpful in that regard. We're now talking with Australia and planning elder caring coordination there and even with stakeholders in Spain.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Linda was also the president of the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts in 2011. And for those of us in the court services biz, that means she's kind of a big deal. All right, let's dig right in. Okay, Sue, can you tell us what is elder caring coordination?
Elder caring coordination is a dispute resolution process developed specifically for high conflict families. So some families, when there's a dispute around an elder's needs, care, safety, can resolve it simply by sitting around the kitchen table. At other times, they need the help of a mediator to help focus them in on what are the issues, developing options so they can find a resolution. But for the high conflict families, mediation is not a good option. They may get stuck in the process or use mediation to harass other family members. So a different process is needed to fit that sort of family. So these family members that are experiencing high conflict now have an option that is specific for them. It helps the family to reduce conflict. And the interesting aspect is how this process helps all the generations. So our focus is on the elder, the elder's needs, wishes, safety. But our focus is also all the generations learning about conflict resolution.
Great. And who is involved in a elder caring coordination? Who are the parties that you're likely to see?
So in general, cases are identified by attorneys, guardians, a judge or magistrate in the court, who are higher conflict. We know in families where there are parents with younger children that about 10 to 15% of those cases take about 80 to 90% of judicial time. Those are the cases that need the most resources. The parties are are very litigious. They run back to court to handle non-legal issues. And that takes a lot of time and attention from the judges who could be using that time for legal issues in other cases. Anecdotally, because there's no specific research on this with older families, but the information that we have been able to glean from the family law professionals and the court in cases where there are older families, guardianship issues, and focus on elders, is that that same kind of inequity arises in terms of time and attention that's needed for higher conflict cases. So like Sue said, these cases need a special process just for them. We know traditional processes like the court and mediation tend to exacerbate their conflict. They are looking for justice, but justice to them means who is going to get the payback or the disciplinary measure, the punishment for getting the best bicycle when they were 10 years old. These families have conflicts that are decades old. The family members are so experienced in this conflict that they have become experts at it. And like Sue said, that's how their relationships are intertwined at this point together. That's how they're used to being together. So elder care and coordination focuses with these families to help them tend together to the elder instead of their personal agendas. And instead of going back to court for non-legal issues, they have a forum together. So these are court-ordered parties, the elder and whoever else has initiated or is involved with the court process, and others who are invited to assist with the process. They may be family members, they could be participants that are bringing in information, they could be caregivers, it could be anybody who will assist in the process, who will then collaborate together with that focus on the elder, that attention on the elder, that can bring them a sense of joint purpose and collaboration.
So how does this work? Can you give an example of an elder care and coordination and what it would be to just sit down and do an elder care and coordination? What does that look like?
So a key piece of elder care and coordination is the focus. What are the immediate concerns that need to be addressed? And then we break things down into very small, very tiny, small, doable steps so that we identify what the strengths of the family members are. We clarify what the elder's needs and wishes are. Elder caring coordination is a 2-year process because we're taking small steps.
So I want to add to that, if that's okay. And In terms of process, elder caring coordination, parties are referred for up to 2 years. And that's so the family does not have to continue going back to court for non-legal issues throughout the transitions of aging that their loved one is experiencing, because those transitions tend to heighten the conflict of the family again. They go back to their initial way of reacting or responding to things that are uncomfortable. And transitions can be very difficult during that time.
So I just want to say that transitions are a very vulnerable time for an older person. If you think about, let's just say there's a fall, they get taken to the emergency room, and then they end up in, let's say, intensive care or another room to recover. And then there will be rehab. They may be transferred to their home. All of those transfers are safety issues. If you think about just how it is for you when you move to a hotel or staying with family members, what it's like to get settled into a different routines, different sounds. But imagine that those that are dear to you are arguing during that time. So instead of being supported and cared for, you feel ripped apart by people who...
Right. Some people who can visit, some people aren't able to visit because of the family alliances. All of those things take place. So elder care and coordination responds to the families by having a process during those 2 years that take them through phases that will help them develop better communication skills and strategies to problem solve, not just as the elder continues throughout the aging process, but also to be able to take it back and use in their own lives. So they start with orientation where they're grounded into the process and they learn about it and the process is explained to them in detail. And they create a joint vision together for how they would really like the life of their elder to be, if at all possible, an aspirational North Star to guide them through the process and to check to make sure if their own decision making is really, or behaviors are helping to guide the elder to according to that North Star. And after orientation and they are engaged in the process, they begin to learn conflict resolution techniques and communication skills so that they can apply those techniques in this process as well as in their own lives. And once they apply them, an interesting thing happens. They begin to see that certain techniques and skills work, that their communication can be better, that this can relieve stress, not just for them, but for other people. And as they see that, they begin to use those tools more and integrate them. And this is all something that's very observable in the process. And it doesn't mean that the family goes through one phase to another phase and doesn't go backward at all, because we know as transitions occur, they may vacillate, but you see them starting to apply and then integrate those skills. And that is really the way that elder care and coordination can address that intractable conflict. And while the goal is not for the family to be able to sing kumbaya, it's really to be able to keep the elder from being in the middle of that conflict. It's to protect the elder actually from that conflict, which has been recognized by a healthcare provider, WellCare, in health plans as an actual health issue, family conflict, as a deterrent to the health of and welfare of elders. While it continues to address that health issue by subsiding the conflict, it's also able to, in many of the cases, assist the family members in getting along better.
So you've talked about transitions in an elder's life would be one time where you would probably see elder care and coordination being very helpful. What are some specific times where you've seen elder care and coordination used? I can think of, you know, like maybe an elder with some self-harming behaviors, such as hoarding, some concerning behaviors that got them into the court. What are some specific examples of where you've seen elder care and coordination be effective?
It's about families where there is high conflict. So they can create a legal motion regarding toenail clippings or haircuts. Like, don't think big, little. This is about families that go to court easily and can fight about anything.
So family situations, competing guardianship emotions, cross allegations, especially when they are unsubstantiated, that constantly take place, not being manageable in a courtroom, impasse during mediation or multiple attempts to mediation, not working out. These are all factors to consider that show that those are families in particular would benefit from this process. The families, they can work, they can identify and work on issue by issue and really want those issues to be resolved. They do great in mediation. But the families that can't work in mediation aren't suitable for mediation. There may be allegations of domestic violence, elder abuse, neglect, exploitation. There may be instances of isolating an elder, competing interests, gatekeeping, meaning prohibiting free access to information, even time and affection with the elder. Those are all instances in the family that would point to elder caring coordination is the better process. And the interesting thing about this in terms of dispute resolution in general is that in every single area that elder caring coordination has been used or where there has been interest in it, the interest in elder mediation has increased in awareness and or use. So it really points to people understanding that not one size conflict resolution method will fit everybody. That families need something that are specific to their unique situation and characteristics.
That's great. That puts another option on the table. And you mentioned elder caring coordination might be able to minimize risk to the elder and abuse. And I want to understand a little better what you see as the intersection of elder abuse and elder caring coordination. What do we mean by elder abuse and how can elder caring coordination help?
Let me answer that. That's the area that I get excited about. It's important that we ask about what's going on in a way that we get more complete information. So elder mediators and elder caring coordinators are taught how to know what the risk factors are for abuse. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. So for example, a woman over the age of 80 has a high risk factor for abuse. That doesn't mean all women over 80 are going to be abused, but it's just a risk factor. So we need to pay attention when we hear certain things. So Linda's been talking about things like gatekeeping and access. So when people don't have access to information or access to the person that they love, we need to be thinking about what is that telling us? How does that fit into a larger pattern of behavior? Is there coercive control involved here? Or is it people jumping to assumptions? And we just need more information and transparency. So we're looking at the full picture. So we do a clear screening in the beginning and throughout the process as we gather more information or as we work with the family, old information makes different sense in this new, as we put the puzzle pieces together, we understand it differently. So the elder caring coordinator is attuned to patterns of behavior that may put the elder at risk. And sometimes it's about referring to adult protective services. Sometimes it's simply about transparency. Maybe we need the bank records brought into the meeting so that everybody can see them. Maybe it's just clarifying what's going on. So every situation is different, but elder caring coordinators are mandated reporters.
So this is really important because we know that 66%, around 66%, and by some studies more, of abuse is for elders is perpetrated by family members. Because elder caring coordination is a process of up to 2 years, that gives the time for the elder caring coordinator a chance to be able to engage the family and form a relationship with the family members. 2 years is a very long time to keep a secret. So compared to an investigator from Adult Protective Services that would go in and have a snapshot of the elder and the elder's place within that family, or compared to a judge that just sees that family for hours and is regulated about what they hear from that family by law, the elder caring coordinator is able to have the time to identify patterns and observe the possibility of risks to the elder and even other participants within that family or within in the process. And in that way, they're able to address those risks before they become abuses, or identify, like Sue said, those abuses and report them to the appropriate authority. Elder caring coordinators do not perform any dual roles. So they are not there as an investigator and they are not there as evaluators, but they are there to be able to refer the family or individuals to the appropriate process for what is needed, make that referral, and then have that ongoing relationship that is untarnished by perceptions of conflict of interest and bias. And they do this, again, unless it's a real safety issue, they do this in a way, as opposed to maybe other professions, that is not confidential. They actually will tell the family that they are going to report when it is at all appropriate to do so, and doesn't impair the safety of anybody by doing that. They may tell them afterward otherwise, but they want to make sure that family knows they're the reporter, because guess who they're going to think reported otherwise? Each other. And then their conflict will rise.
That makes sense. Okay, and I want to go more into this role of the elder caring coordinator, because you've talked about that part of their role is to identify and address risk with the family. And earlier you mentioned teaching effective communication skills to elders and the family and kind of helping them with their own negotiating and problem solving. What other roles does the elder caring coordinator play?
So one of the roles is a conciliator, and that's where the mediation skills can be helpful, is in that conciliator role. We've talked about the screening, teaching. Our teaching is all research-based and supports the family strengths. So we're coaching them in how to approach a situation differently, or let's look at how you tried that last time and was it effective? What could we do now to make it better? Situation. There's also a case manager role. So in the beginning, there's resistance to any intervention. They just want the judge to tell them that they're the good one and the other family members are the bad ones. But judges don't do that. So what we're looking at is case management that helps keep moving the family along in protecting the elder's safety, but also attending to the elder's rights and their own preferences. So even though we may not like it, the elder has a right to say what they want, even if it may be risky or dangerous or against our wishes. But they want to make sure that that things keep moving forward in whatever way that is. And then we start bringing in resources when the family is able to use the resources appropriately so that we're building a team, so that when the elder caring coordinator leaves over the phases, as Linda's talked about, then there's a whole team of people that are in place ready to help. Linda, do you want to talk about some of the other roles?
Yeah, so one of the things that the elder caring coordinator does is provide recommendations to the family, but in a very unique way. The recommendations revolve around how resolutions get made. They're there to help the family make well-informed decisions or help the legally authorized decision maker to make better informed decisions by sharing information, by bringing in information from other resources when necessary, and be able to identify what would be best for the elder at that specific time, because we know it can change. The elder caring coordinator is not, for instance, deciding where mom is going to reside. Will mom stay at home in a way where the home is made more safe for her? Is that possible? Or does mom need a step up? Does she need more social interaction? Does she need more care? And identifying really the places that might be suitable. The EC is not going to make the decision of where she lives, but will help broaden the options and help the family members then narrow the options so that the decision is made regarding the best option for the elder at that time. The elder caring coordinator also can make decisions, non-legally oriented decisions, within the scope of the order. So let's say certain information needs to be brought in. The elder caring coordinator can recommend the kind of information they need. And then if the family is not able to discern how to bring that information in, then the elder caring coordinator can say, okay, well, this person is a doctor. This family member is a doctor. Is it possible you could be the one that goes to get that medical information or medical provider and brings that information in? Or this person is a contractor or a builder, and is it possible for this person to be in charge of getting the information needed to make mom's home safer? And everybody can bring in information. If they can't decide who, the EC can, their elder caring coordinator can help make the decision about who brings information in so they don't get stuck and not bring information in at all.
And I just love that the elder caring coordinator is involved for 2 years, like it's a 2-year appointment. So if during the course of this, the needs of the elder change, not only is that person there ready to make those resource recommendations, but also at the same time teaching all these family members, yes, things are going to change, things are going to adapt, but now we're getting the tools. So when these things come up, you don't have to use the court system every single time. We're training you to address the family's needs and to involve that elder in the decision instead of just yelling about them behind their back.
And an interesting thing about that compared to younger families where parents are dealing with children who become more independent as the years go by, when we're dealing with older families, the elders are frequently becoming less dependent, as not always, but in these cases, less dependent as dependent as the time goes on. And they have less time between those critical moments to wait for decisions to be made. This means the decisions need to be made in a snap of a second in order to be able to address a particular need at a particular time without jeopardizing the health or safety of the elder.
Let me give another example around dementia. So if somebody is progressing on the dementia journey, And a person is trying to be a good caregiver and doing what they would want done for themselves, that's not necessarily what the individual with dementia would prefer. So if you think about just whether it's temperature or sounds or textures or tastes, that some people in the family may have a better understanding of either what the elder wants, what they like, or how their behavior is saying, that's not comfortable for me. Mm-hmm. So understanding the cues from the person, because what we know is people with dementia often do not have their pain addressed. And so the person is doing whatever they can to say, I don't like this. And sometimes their behaviors feel problematic to others and they think, oh, we need to get a higher level of care, when it's really, we need to learn how to listen differently to the elder. What else could that behavior be?
I want to give an example of this, because it just seems to highlight what Sue said and how the relationship of the family members really can affect the care that the elder is giving when they don't separate their needs or their beliefs from the elders. So think of this family where the conflict between the father and the children, the older adult children, was being exacerbated all the time, as the older children would come to the home and believe that the father was no longer able to take care of their mom. So they would go in and they would walk in, and the father would try to set up everything in the home in the way that they had always done before, and they were avid listeners to classical music, and he would turn it up, and he thought he was doing everything right to make the environment wonderful for his children to come and visit. And each time the children came, the mother would get more and more upset. She would end up going into the bedroom, didn't want to see anybody, just throwing the door so that nobody could get in, shutting that door with a very loud noise to make sure everybody knew, stay out. Once the elder caring coordinator was appointed and could help the family with this, it became clear that the mother was not having any adverse reaction to anybody in particular. No one had realized or really even taken the time to talk with her about what was happening. And what it ended up being was that she had an ear condition and tinnitus in the ear, where there was ringing. And when the father was raising the volume of the music to that extent, it became so disturbing and painful to her that the reactions that she was giving were because of the physical ailment only. And she would run into the room and hide under the covers to be able to keep the noise from her. And once the music was off, everything proceeded as normally. But because of what the children had seen, they had already gone to court. They were trying to take the care away from the father. Everybody was in disarray because of this, and it really all could have been prevented. But since this was a family that had some regular way of handling things that was that higher conflict level, they automatically went to that high conflict without being able to look into an issue that could have been resolved very easily.
And Ohio, the state that this podcast is being recorded in, is actually a state that's at the forefront of elder caring coordination, correct? I mean, you are both joining us from other sides of the country, but what do you know about Ohio's program here?
So I will just jump in and say that Ohio has been a model elder caring coordination program, in particular in Stark County with Judge Dixieline Park. she has identified cases and sent them to elder caring coordination, and they have kept statistics that show, I believe it's the first 37 cases that were sent, 34 were able to avoid guardianships, or if they had guardianship that was no longer needed because the family members were able to step up. That is a very impressive statistic that shows how well this elder caring coordination can work to strengthen the self-determination of the elder and the family members. So that part is really very exciting. And we're hoping that the use of elder caring coordination continues to rise throughout the state. We're extremely grateful that for the fourth time, we're going to be able to train elder caring coordinators through the Ohio Supreme Court. You want to talk about that, Sue?
I'm very excited. So Ohio has been such a model in terms of finding the right dispute resolution process for disputes, and also for training people all over. So when we look at the training, I always want to go back to the criteria in order to become, or qualifications to become, an elder caring coordinator. So the first is a person would need to have a master's degree. Second is licensure or certification. So we want to make sure that there's a body that they are responsible to, because elder caring coordination is so new, there is not yet licensure or certification for EC. So we want to make sure there's another group that is making sure that somebody is getting continuing education and holds them accountable to their ethics.
Such as a therapist or an attorney?
Correct. Or nursing background is fantastic, or working with aging population. Lots of variety. Again, interdisciplinary is best.
And it depends on what is regulated or certified within that state.
Right. And we want to see that they have extensive practical experience as a professional working with high conflict families, because this is not for everyone. So we want to know that this is something that they actually enjoy. And then there's three steps in the training. There's family mediation training, elder mediation, and then elder caring coordination. And fabulously, the Supreme Court offers all of those and knows that you need one before the next. And so they offer them in order so that people can get all the training necessary in order to take the elder caring coordinator training, which is in 2021. It is October 25th to 27th.
Thank you. The Ohio Superintendent's Rule 79 specifically talks to or encourages the use of conflict resolution, such as elder mediation and elder caring coordination in these cases. It's been instrumental in helping families get to the court earlier, get that order earlier. So the earlier the case is identified for the process, the easier it is for the families to begin.
So we already have elder caring coordination in different parts of Ohio, like you said, Stark County, and I know Delaware, Montgomery County. So for courts that might be thinking about adopting elder caring coordination and getting it started, does it replace the role of the probate court? Like what's the difference that you see in the role of the probate court versus what elder caring coordination is best suited to?
So it certainly doesn't replace the court at all, because these families have concurrent legal issues that need to be addressed. And elder caring coordination actually needs the court, because they need to be court ordered to have the accountability, so that initially people who are resistant know they have to give it a chance. So the court is is essential to the family as well as the process. But the thing to remember is that elder care and coordination is there to enhance the work of the court, to make it easier for the court as well as the families, because they're just addressing the non-legal issues, so the legal issues and the flow of the case can be more successfully addressed in court. The judge's research shows actually that 100% of the judges who completed outcome surveys for the Virginia Tech University, who had Pamela Teaster and Megan Dolben McNabb as the team leads in this independent research, 100% of those judges were very satisfied with elder care and coordination. They had fewer motions. When there were motions, they were more specific to legal issues. The parties were more amenable to interaction, appropriate interaction in the court. The cases were manageable. They were quicker to resolve in court. So that there was a lot of good feedback to show the benefits of elder care and coordination in relation to assisting the court with those cases.
Let me jump on the back of that is, if anybody is interested in developing a program of elder care and coordination in the area, Linda and I make it as easy as possible for them. So we need a judge who would be willing to sign a court order ordering the family to elder care and coordination. And we have Judge Michelle Morley in Florida that can help train the judges in the process. So, and that's an easy, free opportunity to learn about this. We also need a court administrator, somebody who is the communication liaison, so there's no ex parte communication, that the judge stays in the courtroom and the EC has both Linda, myself, and the pilot site or program administrator to help talk through to see what would be best in a certain case or how the process works in that particular area. And then you need trained ECs. And as you said, Ohio's offering the training. So we make it as easy as possible. We have all the forms. We can tell you how other people have done it. We can help anyone step by step through setting up a program.
So the initiative is supportive of the ECs and all of the programs. They have the opportunity to meet on a monthly basis. There's consultation provided as needed. Again, like Sue said, we have Judge Michelle Morley, who is actually the third co-chair of the Elder Justice Initiative on Elder Care and Coordination, that provides that special link to the court in general. And so we have a complete package to make it as easy as possible for any startup program.
Well, I can just see that the families would probably really appreciate this, especially the elders. I mean, keep their private business out of the open courtroom, be able to discuss it at a table, you know, with the people that already know the situation, instead of like putting embarrassing things in front of the judge about how you can't, you know, take care of yourself as well as you used to, or, you know, things like that, or talking about family conflict, or, you know, admitting that there might be an abuse situation. So I can just see how the older adults themselves would really just appreciate having elder care and coordination as an option.
Well, let's also mention that it's cost effective, that in Stark County, they were able to provide elder care and coordination for free. They got a grant, but in most other areas, it's the parties that pay for the process, just like they would for other services that they obtain, but they are sharing the costs together according to the allocation specified in the court order by the judge. And in this way, instead of each of the parties spending their money individually per court motion, per expert witness, per their own attorney, They're able to share the costs, get a more timely response than they would probably get in court unless there was an emergency motion. And now with COVID, sometimes perhaps even if there is an emergency, they're able to get, you know, much more immediate attention from the elder caring coordinator in a way, like you said, that is private, it's comfortable, it's accessible to them, much easier in terms of scheduling and location.
I'd also like to pick up on that privacy and when we talk about the risk of abuse. So if I'm the elder and the abuser is both my caretaker and my daughter, so I have mixed emotions about it. Shame that I am in this situation at all, and fear that if anything happens to my daughter, who I love and care about, then I don't have anyone to take care of me, and I may have to change where I live, and I don't want to do that. And there may also be guilt involved because I'm a mother, and I raised that child. So what part of that is my responsibility? So because of all the mixed emotions around that, the secrets are kept. They don't want people to interfere in their business. But as Linda said, by developing relationships and being with the family without shame, everybody gets to protect their dignity and move forward with caring for the older person that hopefully they still care about.
So this brings us back almost full circle to when we were talking about safety in the beginning, with 2/3 of the perpetrators of elder abuse or exploitation being family members. Only 1 in 24 of those cases is actually reported. And not just because of the elder, but because of these long-term secrets that families keep, the shame or the fear of reporting on their own at that point. So elder caring coordination serves as that protection all the way through the process while they're able, while the elder caring coordinator is working on with the family to enhance the life of the very person that they say they want to protect.
Well, we've talked certainly a lot about elder caring coordination today. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you think we just need to talk about this in this podcast?
We'll let it end here. But as I said at the beginning, Linda and I could talk a long time.
Okay. Well, here's a bit I like to try at the end of every podcast, and it's called 2 for Me and 1 for You. So there'll be 2 questions for you, the presenters, and 1 question that they will have for you, the listening audience, as a kind of pop quiz to see if you are paying attention today. So the first question is to the presenters. What is an interesting and relatively brief elder caring coordination story that you can share?
So, okay, I'll go first with this one and just give you a snapshot of how something can work out that can show in a very specific way, the long-term effects that could take place in a family where there are warring family members between spouse, the children, grandchildren, siblings of an elder who never liked each other, never learned to really like each other, and they were very clear about that. But at the time that the elder passed away, actually determined how they would share ashes together. So no matter how they felt about each other, they realized that the elder was important to each of them, and that they were each equally important to the elder. And I think that says a lot. Sue, your turn.
Because of time, I'll let Kate ask the second question.
Oh, okay. I think that's just your way to get out of telling a story.
A brief story.
All right. Well, question two is, who is an amazing person you know who's related to mediation, and why do you appreciate them?
So
mediation or elder caring coordination, I will say, for this one, for sure.
And because I wanted to take this one, the most amazing person is Linda Fieldstone. It is her vision, focus, energy, dedication, warm heart. I just can't say enough about Linda. But to move beyond Linda, which is always hard, is there are many, many amazing people. So all the people who have said, I want to be trained as an elder caring coordinator, I'm waiting for cases, I can't wait to help families. These are people saying, I am ready to walk into the fire of these families that are very contentious. And I'm willing to do that because I care about the elder and I care about the grandchildren. I want to see how the family can work together so that a grandchild isn't cut off from being able to see Aunt Sally, who picks her up from school, or is able to grow up knowing their cousins because the family still gets together for holidays. So Linda and all the ECs and Michelle Morley, who we consider to be the judge whisperer.
And I'll just expand on that for a second and also say the courage of the judges and the family law professionals, the attorneys, the guardians, and others that work with those families to embrace a new way to be able to help those families. That can be scary. There can be a lot of resistance or pushback, but those especially who have really understood the benefits and forged ahead with this as leaders, we appreciate them all. And I'm also going to just, I need to say, based on what Sue said, that the collaboration of the three of us, Sue and Judge Morley and myself as the co-chairs, has been a real model, I believe, for how family members, because we've become very close in terms of our work together, but we really work like a good family to be able to move ahead, have discussions, always strive to make things better, push each and challenge each other to do that with great acceptance and admiration and respect. So I needed to add that because I think that this would not happen without that good model that we're also embracing.
All right. So the final question is for one of you to give the audience a knowledge check. What is your pop quiz question that they should be able to answer after listening to your podcast?
So pop quiz question is, in what ways can elder caring coordination protect and safeguard the elder from risks, abuse, and exploitation?
That is great. I think I could answer that one. I'm excited about that one. All right. Well, does either of you have any closing words before we sign off today?
Yes, thank you. You did a great job. We are so appreciative of the Ohio Supreme Court, Kathy Geyer, Kevin Lotz, I hope I'm saying Lotus, sorry. Kevin Lotus and you for making this happen and for giving us the opportunity to assist in any way to bring elder caring coordination to Ohio and to support it as it continues here. And special thanks to all those judges and magistrates and ECs in Ohio.
I think that that's a wrap for today. A huge thank you to Linda Fieldstone and Sue Bronson for this engaging and formative presentation and the work you do to keep our elders safe. And thank you to all of you out there for listening, especially those of you working for justice. I hope you will join us for the next episode of the Civility and Solutions podcast, where guests to the podcast will offer a different dispute resolution alternative for elder-involved cases. Hope you have a great day. Thank you.